Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for a Big Time Talker podcast. I'm Burke Allen. You can get a new episode every Tuesday. Subscribe at Apple, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. We talk to interesting individuals every week. And the show is sponsored by SpeakerMatch.com. SpeakerMatch is the world's largest online virtual speakers bureau. If you're a platform speaker or maybe you're a meeting planner and you need a great speaker, you can find one another at SpeakerMatch.com. We're going to talk television today and comedy, two of my favorite guilty pleasures, with one of the original writers for Late Night with David Letterman, which was named one of the 101 best written TV series ever by the Writers Guild of America. Stephen Weiner joins us from his palatial Batcave studio in New York City. Thanks for being on the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So before we talk Letterman, I want to rewind a little bit and ask you when you first realized that you had the gift of putting pen to paper. How did you decide you could do this for a living and be a writer?
Ever since I was a kid, I always wanted to do something in comedy because I fell in love with classic comedy when I was a kid. Daily television for children was things like Laurel and Hardy movies that Abbott and Costello and Our Gang, all of those. And I fell in love with comedy. Also, it was contemporary when I was a kid as well, whether it was Jerry Lewis in the movies or Dick Van Dyke Show on television. So I fell in love with all that, and I wanted to do something in comedy. I think when I was a kid, the first thing I wanted to be was a comedian, but I discovered at some point I had no skill for that whatsoever. And as you know, eventually, well, my father was a television writer and a playwright, not a comedy writer. He wrote dramatic work, but I understood the life of a writer and as a possible profession. So I think it just became natural. After a certain point in time, I thought I would be a comedy writer. It seemed to be the best way for me to approach the field.
When you talk about having no skill as a comic, what made you think, that's not my bag, that's somebody else's bag, but I can do this part instead?
I just didn't think I would be able to handle it. I mean, you know, I screwed around a little bit. I put myself in a short comedy when I was a film that I made in college, and I didn't like doing it. I don't think I was very good. I did do my writing partner and I did a radio comedy show at the University of Wisconsin student station, WLHA. And it was sort of a Bob and Ray's kind of show. And that was fun to do. I enjoyed doing that. But I, frankly, you know, it was more important to get the written material in there to show what we could do as writers. And eventually that material, I'm jumping the gun here, but it was the radio material that we did that got us our first gig, which was working for the National Lampoon for a little while.
You just mentioned you had a writing partner. What does that mean? For people that are uninitiated with how it all works, a writing partner is what? You guys sit in a room and you bounce jokes off one another?
Yeah, usually his name was Carl Tiedemann. He went to my high school, Horace Mann in New York. Also a big fan of classic comedy, so we bonded over that. And that's basically it, although it can work other ways too. Some of the things we've done, the short film that got us on the Letterman show started with an idea of mine, and then I wrote a first draft on my own. Then he came in and added material to that, and then we tossed it back and forth to finish it. So there are many different ways of working, but usually when you're working on a TV show, if you're a team, you're in a room and that's who you're with all day long, and that's how you write.
I read when you worked for National Lampoon that you worked for the guy who will forever be known as Stork in the Animal House movie, the late great Doug Kenny. What was he like? Because I read that he was one of those, and it's almost cliche, Stephen, to talk about it, but one of those really funny guys that were really sort of tragic behind the scenes.
He didn't seem tragic when we were working with him. That's all I can say. I mean, obviously, in retrospect, you could say there was some tragedy there. He was terrific. And if I do recommend, there's a Netflix film about his life, and the title of which has just escaped my mind, but it could be tracked downable easily enough. It was pretty good call of what he was like. He was an enormously supportive person. He was just a really good guy to work with, and particularly for our first professional work of any kind. I mean, he was always helpful. He could help make something better, but you know, he didn't have that kind of ego where, you know, the idea is not to ever say to somebody else, you're good. He right. did that very often. He made us feel very comfortable in that we felt that we deserved to be there, which because of him. because of how he worked with us. So later on, after we lost track with him, obviously of him, there was obviously some darker times, and it's talked about in the film. And the film was based on a biography about him, which seemed accurate to me. I mean, we didn't know him that well off out of work. I do remember visiting him occasionally at his house and once or twice for lunch, but even that was tied up with work. But he just was the kind of person that you were comfortable around. He made you comfortable.
Right, right. It's fascinating to me. And when you and I met for lunch in New York, how different our own personal backgrounds are. And yet we share that love of classic comedy and all that. But you grew up, as the son of a writer, and I grew up in a very blue collar world where, it's beyond the realm of imagining that you could make a living writing jokes. And I wonder if the fact that your dad was a writer, although not a joke writer, not a comedy writer, was that something that made you, Stephen, feel like, yeah, I could do this. I really could make a living doing this.
That's a complex question, because my father, who had done very well during the live days of television, was an important part of that. By the time I was growing up, it was getting harder for him to find work because he couldn't really work in the television of the 60s. It just drove him crazy. He tried a couple of times, but the kind of work he did was not really welcome in a much more cookie cutter type of TV that went there. So I learned pretty quickly that this was not necessarily a way to get rich and famous.
Yeah.
So it did seem to me that, I mean, I saw it as a profession. It was something that I could see as something that one did, but in order for anybody to go into writing of any kind, you better really, really like doing it, because it's a very tough job. And I'm talking about any kind of writing, book, fiction or nonfiction or journalism or TV or anything like that, because they're always no permanent jobs in show business. And it's particularly true of writers, I think, who tend to be considered to have a sell-by date by television in general. So, you could be very successful for a while, and then you sort of age out of the business. That's how they perceive you. So you really better like doing it if you're going to go into it.
Is that what happened with your dad? He aged out, or his skill set?
No, I don't think he did. I mean, eventually he would have, but I think it really was the change in television. If you look at television in the 50s, the live anthology TV show plays that were on, it was a writer's medium. My father always said that the reason for that was commercial too. Everybody said, oh, they respected art in those days. He said, no, it wasn't that, because televisions, when they first were being sold, were expensive and they were a luxury item.
Right.
And the people who could afford them tended to be upscale people, urban people who had the kind of
they
jobs.
Had the means to have a TV.
Exactly. And they also tended to be well-educated, and they were attracted to this kind of television. So TV, that was put on for them. By the time the 50s were over, it really had become a complete mass medium. And by that point they were doing, I won't name shows by hand, but name anything from the 60s. And yeah, there's some really good shows in the 60s, but it's a different type of television. And I think certainly for drama, I think my father felt it was not, it was no, they were no longer doing the kind of writing that he did.
So would he kind of turn his nose up at whatever?
No, he didn't turn his nose up. He just could, he tried, and it just was unworkable. It just wasn't the way he worked. He would get a good script that he was proud of, and then they would rewrite it and ruin it. and he, believe me, he's not the only writer from that period who complained about that kind of thing, and who did leave television in the 60s for that reason. People who had been successful in the 50s. If you look at those names, the names that were so important in the 50s, very few of them were writing television in the 60s.
And you and your high school friend, it was Carl, correct?
Mm-hmm. Carl Tiedemann, yes.
Went away to college, get the job at National Lampoon. And then what does your dad say to that?
It wasn't.
You come home and say, Dad, I'm writing comedy for a living?
Well, it wasn't quite that simple. And it wasn't really a job at National Lampoon. We freelanced, sold articles to them, so I don't want to make it sound bigger than it was. My father knew I loved comedy. And, and so when I said I was going to write it, we kicked around for a while too, before we had any real success. The Lampoon was a freelance couple of sales. It didn't immediately lead to anything, as nice as it was. So he said, he was very, always very supportive, and he tried to help however he could. And he was great about, you know, I mean, he loved that I was doing it. I heard that he had told friends of his he didn't know where the, he loved that I was writing, but he didn't know where the comedy came from. And the fact is, that sort of came for him too, because he also loved comedy. He didn't write it, but he loved it. You know, he used to watch, he would watch the Dick Van Dyke Show with me. He, from an early age, would let me to stay up and watch Jack Benny with him. It was his favorite. So he adored comedy. He just didn't write it. So I think his enthusiasm, I mean, he took me to a Marx Brothers double feature. And, he, you know, the first time I saw them, the Bank Dick, the W.C. Fields film, was on television. He said, well, yeah, I think you should watch this. I think you'd enjoy it. He let me stay up to watch Jack Benny with him, who was one of his favorites. So he introduced me to comedy, too. And the fact that he himself didn't write comedy and was surprised that I could, I always thought was interesting, because in a sense, it was almost inevitable, that combination.
You told me when we had lunch together that as an adult, you actually got a chance to meet Dick Van Dyke. How great is that? You watch him when you're a kid and then you get a chance to meet him and talk to him.
Well, with more than that, we wrote for him. My then partner, Hillary Rollins, and I were hired by Nick at Night to write a special that they were doing when they had the Dick Van Dyke Show as a regular feature. And also they had Dick Van Dyke as so-called chairman of Nick at Night. And they were mostly using him for commercials, but they had an idea for doing a show in which he would pick his five favorite episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show and introduce them. Right. So they had worked with Hillary before. They didn't know me. Hillary brought me in. The idea was to finally give him something funny to do, because mostly he was doing straight commercials. And we thought if we could sort of combine that and get a little comedy into it, it'd be great. But yes, it was unbelievable, because, you know, when I was a kid, one of the things I most wanted to do would be to write for, to work for Dick Van Dyke. And when I first started doing it, and I had reached the age at that point, I guess, oh gosh, this would probably be in my early 40s or mid 40s that this happened early, I think. At that age, you sort of set aside your childhood dreams. You don't think, you realize some are going to happen and some won't. And then this one just came out of the blue. So, yeah, it was great fun to do this. And he's an amazing person. He's exactly the man you would think he would be. He's not a letdown. He is very generous, friendly, easy to talk to. It was a great couple of days. It really was, working on that show.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah, I would be nervous about meeting someone that I idolize like that. You never want it to go sideways, right? You never want to be let down by meeting your idols.
Well, I think he's probably used to, got used at a very early age to people being sort of flummoxed around him. Yeah. And some artists, you know, will just sort of use that as an excuse to sort of blow off people. He doesn't. He makes you feel comfortable. And, you know, I think he's just that kind of person.
To be able great to guy. Do. I want to spend some time with you on Letterman. You went on to do some other interesting work. You wrote stand-up comedy for one of my favorite stand-ups of all time, Robert Klein, and also did.
I have to interrupt you on that one, because one thing no one does with Robert Klein is write his stand-up. That was his, and always his. We wrote for him on a couple of TV shows he did, which is a different type of. I mean, it's still writing for him, but it's not writing stand-up. And that's
interesting. So he's, as a stand-up, he does all his own stuff.
Always his own material. I remember once I had a joke that I told him, a joke that I had thought of, and he stopped. He said, you know, I could use that. I could get laughs with that. And then he said, I can't do it. Because as good as the joke is, he said, my stand-up is mine. I would feel uncomfortable bringing anybody else's material. And I completely understand that. I mean, I thought it was wonderful that he thought a joke of mine was raised to the level of something he might have used. So that, you know, I felt honored by that.
When you write for somebody like that, who is also a great writer, and you're writing for television, he hosted one of those bloopers and practical joke shows, right?
That's the show we wrote for. It was a segment within that show where it was basically Robert Klein on the streets of New York, a little bit like the kind of remote pieces that David Letterman did. And we think of ourselves as professional, and we made a big mistake that he was very generous about. But the first day we wrote for him for one of those remotes, we were so, our heads were so much in the Letterman space that we wrote a couple of sarcastic jokes for him. And he said, you know, that's Dave. That's not me. And so we got that clear immediately, and then we were able to adapt ourselves to Robert's style. I don't think that issue ever came up again, but it's a good point for people when to writers to realize if you are writing for performers as opposed to writing a script, you know, a movie script or a TV script where it's something of your own creation. If you're writing for a performer, you have to write in that performer's style. And I've always said you can take the exact same joke premise, and if you wrote it for two different comedians, the wording would have to be different just because their rhythms are different.
Tell me about how you actually landed a job on the David Letterman show. This was before the Letterman show was even the Late Night with David Letterman, right? It was not on the air.
Well, the morning show had been canceled. So he'd done the morning show already.
Which very few people remember.
I do. I loved it. I was a huge fan. So this getting a chance to do this was a big one for me. We had made, my partner and I made a short film, student film, called King of the Z's, which was a parody documentary about the world's cheapest movie studio with a fictionalized studio called Vespucci Pictures. And of course, we made the interview clips, and we also made our own black and white film clips from this studio. And we had actually had this idea, I think one of the few good ideas I could actually say I was involved in my lifetime, which is that most student films in those days, and probably still, are made to either promote someone either as a director or as an actor. And we thought if we could make a student film where the writing is really clearly, obviously good, that maybe it would help us in our career. So we made this movie, and we had a fair amount of success with it. It played the Telluride Film Festival. It was picked up by Showtime, which ran it for 2 years between features. And it had been around for a while. It had gotten attention, but as it happened, a man who worked for Rollins and Joffe, the famous comedy managers, Jack Rollins and Charles Joffe, who managed David Letterman, one of the guy who worked there named Stu Smiley, saw it on Showtime, and he reached out and contacted NYU and found us. And he was talking, this happened to be about 2 or 3 months before the Letterman, late night Letterman show was about to start. And he called me and we started talking. He said, I'd really love to work with you guys. Is there something you'd be interested in doing? And I just said, well, you know, if you're Rollins and Joffe and you're doing this is the Dave Letterman show, I worship the morning show. I thought Dave was amazing. Is there any chance you might be able to get our material over to them? And he said, yeah, well, let me give it a try. And he did. And David and Meryl Marco, the original head writer, saw the film and liked us and interviewed us and eventually hired us off of that. Now, I should add that one of the actors in our movie became famous through the Letterman show. We had met a guy named Calvert DeForest in an earlier film we had made. And there was just something about this guy that really amused us. And when we wrote this script, we had to find the kind of actors who would have played at the world's worst studio, and Calvert just came to mind.
Right out of Central Casting with that.
Right out of Central Casting, and we wrote a lot of him, and he's in all of the clips and in the movie. And for those who don't know, he became the character known as Larry Bud Melman on the Letterman Show. The way that we used him, I think, if people watched the Letterman Show, you'd recognize that the Calvert Larry Bud Melman connection is, you know, that's basically there. That's who he was. So we got the Letterman job. Short answer. In fact, during the job interview with David and Meryl, they said, you know, we're looking for somebody like that little guy in your movie for our show. And we said, well, that's the guy you're looking for. Don't look no further. You know, so that's where Larry.
When I would watch that show back in the early 80s, I always wondered, is this guy playing a character, or is he really like that in real life? So what was the real Larry Bud Melman like in real life? Was he that guy?
That's basically him. I mean, we made it. I mean, yes and no, because obviously he wrote these kind of weird, you know, almost fantasy like speeches that he would make that. No, he would not talk like that. But he was a very nice guy. The thing is, the performance was him. And he had been trying to be an actor for years and not really had any success at it. So he came to any open audition anywhere. And the irony, of course, was that this was a man who wanted to be a star all his life, and that we made him a star not for exactly what he really wanted to be, but for what he actually was on some level. So there was a great, this amazing thing that suddenly this guy, who, by the way, while he was doing our show, was also keeping his day job, which was a receptionist at drug rehabilitation clinic. He would go there, and then he would come to NBC and become a TV star. I think most of the people at the clinic had no idea who he was. They didn't watch the show. So he kept that job for quite a while until they found out.
I was in
the
studio audience for a taping of Late Night with David Letterman, and I think it was 1986 or 1987. Mm-hmm. And it's always interesting to sort of be a fly on the wall and watch all that happening. But I wonder if you could sort of pull the curtain back and take us behind the scenes as to what would happen as you built, you know, five new shows a week, every week. What was that process like for you?
It was very businesslike in a way, because, you know, you had so many slots to fill in a week, and the decision we made, and we're doing this week, we put on the board, which laid out what each show was like. And you'd write your material in the office, turn it into Merrill at the end, you know, when you were done. And usually the way if it was something like a viewer mail or a prop piece, you know, like new products, things like that, she would take her favorite gags from everybody's submissions, put them together into one bit. Every now and then there were bits that were totally one team or one writer's vision, but that's how it worked. Then you would turn it in, and then when it was done, whether it was the same day or the next day or whatever, you might come down to rehearsals, you might not, it depended. And then, you know, when the show was on, you were like everybody else. We're standing in the back and just watching and hoping it would get less.
How early did you roll in the morning, and then when did you get out of there at night?
We used to come in when Merrill was head writer, used to come in about 10. And the show, I think, taped from 5 to 6, as I recall. If Don Giller is listening to this, I'm sure he can correct me, the world's number one Letterman expert. And then, you know, basically we would write that after the wrap, we would go home usually.
How many writers were on staff in that first couple of years when you were there?
I think it was 8, initially. Merrill not counting Merrill, who was head writer. There was 8 staff writers. It got larger later. But even within that, there were 2 teams on the show, but, you know, Carl and me and Tom Gamble and Max Pross. So in a sense, it was almost 6 on some level, because Merrill would get material from individual writers and teams, and that was what she was working from.
So for the uninitiated who are just fans of any of those shows, the thing that's interesting, I think, for younger people now is they see David Letterman as this elder statesman of television. Back in the day, when you launched that show, this was way off the grid, crazy different, unlike anything else that was on late night television. It was the antithesis of Carson. What were you going for? And what were your marching orders? Did they say just to be different? What did they want it to be like?
Well, they didn't talk to us about that. So that would have been Merrill, you know, working with the network. I think Merrill and David had this vision right from the start. I think the morning show had gotten great reviews and poor ratings. And they think they had faith in David. But there was also a technical reason why the show was as crazy as it was, which is that it followed Johnny Carson. And you couldn't follow Johnny Carson with imitation Johnny Carson. You had to do something else. Right. So I think NBC actually welcomed the crazy nature of what we were trying to do on that show. And I think Carson, who, you know, was co-producer of the show in those days, that's what he wanted as well. So it was a business decision in some part, which was out of our range of vision. But we all loved that part of the show. We loved the idea that we could do pretty much anything. We all thought of ourselves as like kids in the basement, like screwing up the network, you know, just messing with everybody. And I think Merrill and David had an incredible vision that made the show unlike anything else that was on TV at the time.
And at that time, I think Carson was still a 90-minute show. And so you guys were
No,
12:30?
No, actually, it was not, because they had moved. He'd moved to an hour in the later days of Tom Snyder's show. Tom Snyder, the Tomorrow Show, had aired originally from 1 to 2 a.m. And then when Carson decided to cut back to an hour, he did a 90-minute show for a while, which failed. The hour show had been a success. The 90-minute show, it wasn't his fault. The network screwed with him on that show and made him change what the show was. And so he got canceled. And because NBC had this big contract with Dave, and they figured that this was the ideal place to put him to try it, to try him out. And so we followed Tom Snyder into Tom. We were into Tom's offices, and we found Tom Snyder, who was a great talent and who David respected tremendously. And if you remember, when Dave moved to CBS, Dave had the rights to pick what he wanted for his follow-up show, for the show that followed him, and he hired Tom Snyder.
When you watch the show, when you watch David Letterman or even the guys today, the Jimmy Fallons, Jimmy Kimmels, to most of us who are, again, just fans, it seems very off the cuff. It seems like, you know, when Letterman says something funny, he's just a genuinely funny guy. Or when Paul Schaefer would do a funny rejoinder. How much of that is scripted and how much of it is the guys?
David Letterman was the greatest ad-libber I've ever seen in this profession. The only one who was in the same league with Steve, that was Steve Allen. And I used to say, the kind of sweet frustration of writing the show is that we could never write jokes as funny as what Dave could say on his own. So if you see Dave bantering with Paul or doing things like that, that's just Dave. And if you see Dave ad-libbing with the guest, 99.9% it was Dave. I mean, I remember once there was a time Dave had Ron Popeil on. I don't know if you remember who he is.
The hair club guy.
Well, he did he did all these.
All the gizmos, right?
The gizmos, right. So they had a bunch of those things that with him on the show. And Meryl came in and said that, you know, to all the rest, you know, Dave would like a couple of ad libs just in case, you know, if you can think of anything funny about these products that he's selling. And I actually got a Dave ad lib on the air, but that was so rare. You know, that really was not something we were asked for or needed to be done. And I think Dave just had as a safety backup, more than capable of doing it without us. But I love the fact that he actually made it sound like an ad lib and got a laugh with one of my lines there.
So you never wrote any of the questions that he asked the interview guests?
Oh, no. No, so the segment producers would give Dave a list of topics and possible areas to talk about. But they didn't write jokes. Dave didn't need anybody to write jokes for the interviews. That's just all him.
I learned when we had lunch, and this is what led me to having you on the podcast, that you wrote one of the most legendary David Letterman bits that he took with him onto the CBS show, and he did it, I think, until the very last show, the throwing the pencil through the window bit. How did that come to be?
You know, it's not that good a joke. I mean, it was a
Come on.
No, wait. I'm going to explain this. It was a viewer mail joke. It's one of the first, like the first couple of weeks of the show. I can't remember again, paging Don Giller for the date. But the somebody had written a letter which said, is the glass, you know, on your set in the windows, is that real glass? So the joke, actually the original joke, I wanted to make it more of a joke because I just thought throwing something, breaking the window is not a much of a gag. So originally I said he crumples up the letter and throws it in through the window, but the letters were always on cardboard. So he just picked up a pencil and did it. And I swear to you, if you see the original bit, it does not get that big a laugh. And I don't think it deserved that big a laugh. It wasn't that great a joke. The thing is, Dave did it twice more that night, about three times the next day, and he did it forever after. So it became a running gag. And, you know, so that became a sort of legendary thing. And it attaches to my name, which I'm happy to have it do, but it makes me laugh because, I mean, it's not a joke that I would say, here, this is what I do for a living. You know, it was just a literal throwaway joke.
So for you as a guy that is someone who crafts comedy, this is what you do for a living. You polish these things like diamonds. What makes a great joke? What's the essence of a great joke?
You know, I think that's almost an unanswerable question because it really depends on what type of joke and what kind of setting and what you're doing. Jokes have to be different for everything that you do it in. A joke for a variety show is different from a joke from a sitcom, which is different from a joke for a play or a movie or a book, although there can be a crossover, obviously. And the thing is, you just have to know it when you see it, and you have to have faith in your own ability to make it work. And if people laugh, you probably can keep your job. If they don't, you're probably out of work.
When you were writing for Letterman and you did five shows a week, I remember this specifically. I remember being up there and they did two episodes on Thursday, the week that I was up there.
Right. It was not that way when I was there. I should mention that during the time I was there, it was four shows a week, and Friday was SCTV. So when I was there, we never did five shows a week.
If you're writing, first of all, you've got a partner, I guess, that you have to get to laugh. You guys have to come to agreement on things. But then it goes through this other jurying process, for lack of a better word, to see what actually makes it on the air. Is it the situation like that, Stephen, where there's sort of this crushing defeat that happens if you don't land jokes on the show? They don't actually make it onto the air?
No, because you'll know there's the crushing defeat comes when you stop getting your jokes on altogether, and then you know that your days are numbered. But in every show I've worked on, by the way, handles this kind of thing differently. But in the Letterman days, the odds of getting an average number of jokes in on a regular weekly basis, if you're good, was good. And so the other jokes that you know you would get, if you got two jokes out of a page of 10, that was a good day, and you got used to that, and that was fine. So nothing about that was bothersome. As long as you were getting material on the air, you were happy.
And when you brought your old high school friend makes it to the Letterman mm-hmm. show with you, is that mm-hmm. right?
We had worked. Yeah.
Were there knockdown, drag out fights with this individual over comedy and what's funny? And
no, we knew each other's style pretty well. So I think there were disagreements, but if that's going on, the team's not going to make it. So we knew each other's style pretty much. So and you also have to learn to be honest with each other as well. And I think we were. I remember when I started writing with another partner, with Hillary, we both realized we had written a script that wasn't as good as it could have been because we had been afraid to call each other out on a joke we didn't think was good enough. And the moment we started being terribly nasty to each other, the jokes got much better. No, you can't write that. That's terrible. No, we can't have that in the script. You have to be honest about it, open with that kind of thing.
Lots has been written. Lots has been said about David Letterman behind the scenes. And now this was 40 years ago when you worked with him.
42, yeah.
40. About him, being super intense and really not happy and in any way. What was the David Letterman off camera like when you work with him at the launch of that show?
I think it's fair to say that nobody felt that they knew David or really knew him as a person. Our interaction with him was good. I mean, I had never had a problem with him personally. In those days, Dave would come in the morning. We're all working on the same floor. He'd walk by your office and he'd say, hi, Dave. Hey, guys, whatever. He'd go into his office. We didn't have a lot of interaction with him. It's very rare that anybody had more than a brief conversation with him because he's kind of a private guy and that's just the way he was. So as far as his intensity, that was unfortunately Meryl's problem. She's the one who had to deal with whether he was happy or unhappy or whatever was bothering me at the time. Our job was, as long as our jokes were getting on, it wasn't an issue. But I also think, certainly in those days, David had was very supportive and respectful of his writers. And I remember more than one occasion when he would make a point of coming back saying he really liked a joke for a bit. And he's not a comfortable social individual. So when he did that, you realize that that it wasn't easy for him to necessarily stop and say that kind of thing. Whereas it might be easier for you or I to say it, but it was harder for him. And the fact that he did it made me think, well, that means a lot that he made himself do that. I liked him. I didn't know him, don't know him now, but I liked him and I sure as hell respect him as an artist.
I did an event with Paul Schaefer 3 or 4 years ago in Las Vegas, and it was at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, and we walked, no more than 300 feet. And when you walk with Paul Schaefer in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. it's a slow walk because everybody sees him. Everybody feels like they know him. Mm-hmm. I wonder at the launch of that show, how quickly you guys figured out there's really some there. This is going to be a big thing.
The show?
Was there a moment?
I think we all thought it was going to be a good show. And I think we thought the 12:30 slot was the right slot, so it had a chance of being a successful show. I do remember talking to, I think, our associate producer, I think she was billed as Liz Anderson, the day before the first show was going to be on. And she said, what do you think? You think it's going to be a hit? And I said, yeah. She said, I think it might be. And she said, how long do you think it'll run? I said, oh, I think it might run as much as 5 years even. So I was being generous and thinking it would be a hit. So, you know, I don't think we ever expected it to be that big a hit. But I also have to say, when you're writing a TV show, you're running in place and you don't really have even time to think about whether it's going to be what the future is. It's just getting that day's show done.
Sure. Sure. And then you look up after a couple of years and it's been an everyday thing. And I found it interesting, too, that you were hired. Your next job was sort of completely different. With this new Mickey Mouse Club for the Disney Channel, but they actually hired you because they wanted somebody to write sort of this hip, edgy comedy for these kids when they relaunched the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah, the story behind that, as I understand it, so, and this is always, you know, passed from person to person, that Michael Eisner was the one who wanted the Mickey Mouse Club on the air, and because he thought it was part of the Disney brand. That a lot of the people who worked in the company did not think this was a good idea. They didn't think it could be a success again, and so. But they were told make it happen. So I think the idea was, what can we do to make it not like the old show? And I think that everybody who spoke to us about it, the people who were the development people who first contacted us, said we want to do a hip version of the Mickey Mouse Club. They didn't know what that meant. I don't think we didn't know what that meant. They said that we didn't necessarily believe them, that they really wanted that if they knew what that actually meant. So we didn't know what that was going to be. And, you know, I would say this is the job. Neither Carl nor I really wanted this job, because it would mean relocating to Orlando. It would mean writing for kids television, which was not an interest of either of ours. Right. So we sort of, and of course, we were completely relaxed when we went into job interviews, which means we gave great job interviews. You know, it's like when you're relaxed, that's when you're going to.
They didn't smell get the flop sweat on you. There was no desperation.
No, there was nothing. No, I mean, we were completely relaxed. It was more, it was almost like, I wouldn't say we're saying it's like, well, let them come sell us. We don't have to sell them. I don't think it was that, but I think it was like, if this happens, you know, we'll see whether we want it or not. If it doesn't happen, we didn't feel like we lost anything. So yeah, they did want a hip version, but they didn't know what that was. So it did become the job when we did get the job of all of us on the show. And we had a fantastic head writer in Alan Silverberg, who was involved, who hired everybody and also helped us, you know, together we all formed what that was. But we were working from scratch. It was not, I mean, the old show, the only thing that was left over from the old show was the idea of Mouseketeers and the idea of theme days. Everything else was new.
So you always hear about these sitcom writers who are stressing out because they got to write one show a week. And, and you, again, are in a place where you did how many shows a week?
That was five shows a week, and it was cable, so there were no commercials. There were lots of other things on the show. There were songs and, you know, there were audience sections, and there was a serial 3 days a week. Like that was like the old show. But still, we were doing, and we had five writers when we were there. And it was between 11 and 13 individual comedy pieces a week. And we believed strongly that they had to be really individual pieces. They told us they wanted Saturday Night Live for kids. We amongst us said we want SCTV for kids, which meant we were trying that, you know, Saturday Night Live was always done very well with what are called refillables in the business, where you take a character that the audience knows and certain running gags and sort of essentially do the same sketch with some changes each week. Well, Alan believed, and we believe too, making ourselves difficult for us, that yes, we could have characters on the show, but the ways they appeared had to be different each time, the way they did on SCTV. So that made it even harder, but it was something we really believed in and what we wanted it to be. So yeah, it was that was the most work I ever did on any show I've ever been on.
What was different about writing for kids, for teenagers, than writing an adult show like Letterman?
You know, when we first did that first job interview, one of the executives asked us, how would you write a show for kids? And I just said off the top of my head, well, we wouldn't. We'd write a show for adults and then cut out the stuff the kids wouldn't understand. And I was told later that he had apparently quoted that to other people when he was doing interviews. And I'm not sure I knew what that meant. I think I had a basic idea of what that meant. But the answer is ultimately that if you're a good comedy writer, you're not writing for, you're doing a kid's show, you're writing it. It's just like anything else. You're trying to get laughs. You're not writing down to anybody. If you write down to anybody, you're not a good writer. So I've always said about comedy in general that comedy writers basically write to make themselves laugh first, their friends laugh second, and everybody else third. And if you are really good enough, tough enough on yourself, and your friends have strong taste, then you do those one and two, you could probably do three. And on the Mouse Club, we were always trying to make each other laugh. You know, we were, it was trying to be funny, period. And the answer became, if you were writing a funny show, but you only had kid cast members, what do you write? Well, you write about school, you write about families, you write about, but we also did TV parodies, we did commercial parodies, same kind of stuff you see on any other show. And we did not write down in those pieces. We wrote stuff that, you know, would, I believe, go over it. And I think, you know, for people who did see the show, who saw it with their parents, very often the parents would enjoy it too, because they would realize there was stuff that may have been even over the kids' heads that we were putting in, not deliberately, but just because that's the way we write. And but the kids liked it too, so it worked.
Were there big disagreements with you and like the set designers, where you would write something elaborate and then they got to go and figure out how to build that and make that work? How does that work behind the scenes?
Well, you know, that again, it's a different department. So basically, you know, on the Disney show where you did have sketches and sets had to be built, we would write the sketches. Alan would choose which ones he wanted. Then he would pass it on to executives. They would get vetted. Then it would go to the production people. The production people, you know, you have a pretty good sense of what you can and can't do on a TV show. And, you know, a certain amount of sets are going to be built because they have to be built for a sketch. So generally, it was not a problem. That was not a problem. And I think that the production people, who God knows worked incredibly hard, probably harder than we did because they had longer hours, they also liked that challenge. They liked being able to do something big. You know, we did a Star Trek The Next Generation parody, which meant they had to build the Enterprise for a 5-minute sketch.
Wow. And you filmed this on set at one of the theme parks, right? In Orlando?
Well, the show was shot in the Disney MGM Studio theme park. The reason the show existed on some level was because they were opening this theme park, which is now called the Walt Disney Studio, I think, or what was then the team thing with MGM. And they were building a real studio because Nickelodeon had one. And they want, you know, and in their theme park, and this was the Disney MGM theme park was an answer essentially to try to get some of the tourists away from Nickelodeon. So they had to put a show in there, and nobody wanted to move to Orlando. So they created a show and the Mickey Mouse Club, and they said, and that said, this show is going to be done in Orlando and people are going to have to come, down and shoot there. So we were part of the tour. You know, they had little trains of people that would come past the bungalows where we worked. They would pass our windows literally every 2 minutes, and then they would be walked past. They had a viewing area over the set where the studio was, and they would watch the show being recorded. We worked from Tuesday to Saturday because Saturday was a big day at Disney theme parks. So they wanted us to be there for at least one of those days. So there's something for people to look at. So it's an unusual way to make a TV show. And it was not a terribly well-equipped studio. And eventually, after our show ended, they tore down the studio and expanded the park. And now there's no trace left of anything we did in that theme park anymore.
That's sad. When I watched the Oscars this year, I saw Ryan Gosling do this big, huge production number. And I knew that I was going to be talking to you for the podcast. And I thought to myself, you know, Ryan Gosling, along with all these other kids, got this incredible training on how to do stuff like that on that show. You were there, I guess, from the beginning. Did the kids come in super talented already? Like, did you go, wow, I can't believe this young person can do this thing?
Well, I will say Ryan Gosling was after my time there, but I will say yes. The answer is no. The answer is they were hired usually for one skill. So someone was hired because they're a really good singer. Somebody else was hired because they was really good at actor. Someone was really good at comedy. A couple of them were good at, you know, music and comedy. Some of them were really good dancers. But that show was an incredible training ground, and everybody had every day had lessons in everything across the board. So suddenly, people who couldn't act became really good actors. The people who you didn't necessarily think were funny would reveal a real comedy talent. People who couldn't sing would become singers. You know, everybody had to learn how to dance. And, you know, the thing about Ryan Gosling, again, for someone who didn't work with him, I didn't know him there, but, you know, he had gotten famous as a dramatic actor. But when I saw Barbie and everybody said, ooh, he could do comedy. And I looked at Barbie and says, that's sketch comedy, what he's doing there. He's playing a sketch character. So that would have been part of his training. So if I don't know whether he was able to do that when he was first there, because I wasn't there. But even if he hadn't any skill at that, he would have learned it. And so that when I literally looked at it and said, oh, that's his Mickey Mouse Club training, actually. the Barbie movie.
And there were so many of those folks that, went on to have hugely successful careers, partly in, I'm sure, the training that they received in the Mickey Mouse Club. When you were writing for them, did it change the way that you wrote at all? Was that, was there ever a little thing in the back of your head that said, "Ah, I better not do that. This is for a 14-year-old girl. Ah, I better not do that. This is for a kid."
Well, I mean, anytime you write anything, you're writing, you have to write for the people you're writing for and for the job you're writing for. So, you know, your mind would not necessarily go in those directions. But we worked very hard on not trying to ever dumb it down, and usually we could get fairly smart jokes past the executives, which certainly in the first couple of seasons. For reasons that would probably take way too long to explain for this interview, fourth season got a little more complicated, and they got a lot much more difficult to work with, which is actually the reason at the end of the season that the entire original creative staff pretty much left. We all left on our own steam because it wasn't fun anymore. So a lot of things that we got through in the early seasons would not have gotten through in the fourth season. So right. At that point, it wasn't fun for us. But we just tried to write the funniest sketches we could think of for the people that we were, the actors that we were working with, who just happened to be between 12 and 15 or 16.
Now, you were in on the ground floor for David Letterman. You're also in on the ground floor for the new Mickey Mouse Club. So I want to ask you the same question. How quickly did you realize this was a big hit? Because, you know, the story I have always heard about that show is that, you know, Disney really didn't realize what they had there. And in fact, that show was sort of the launching pad for the Disney Channel. Disney Channel would probably not be where it is today without that show being its first hit. So how quickly did you guys realize you had the tiger by the tail?
We didn't realize. I mean, we knew the show was successful because it kept getting renewed. And the show got a lot of fan mail and, you know, all that kind of thing. But they didn't say anything to us about the show being really successful. I don't think they got it, to tell you the truth. And I don't think they got it. They get it to this day. Now, it's a whole different slate of people working there now, but I don't think they ever realized how beloved this show had become. We certainly didn't. And of course, we have a mutual friend in Mouseketeer, Jennifer McGill.
Right.
And you know, all of these wonderfully talented people we work with who are reaping the benefits now of the love of the audience still after 30 years. I think we all thought the success. I'm pretty sure we all thought, well, I know we all thought we walked away from the show that's the last anybody would even think about this show. I remember my agent when I got back saying, don't even put it on your resume. It won't do you any good. And I remember talking to a Mouseketeer years later and telling him that story. And he said, well, my agent said the same thing to me. And then I found out sometime after that, all of their agents said the same thing to them. Every Mouseketeer's agent said, don't put it on your resume. It'll do you no good. Now, it's been 30 years, and this show is still beloved. And there are people I've met, fans of this show, really nice people, most of them surprisingly normal, who actually, you know, they remember the shows better than we do. And, you know, it was a huge part of their life, and it still is. We had none of us had any idea that would have that kind of life. We really didn't. The original show had that kind of life, but we thought this one was a flash in the pan at best. I mean, we thought it was a good show, don't get me wrong, but we didn't think it was going to have that kind of an impact.
Stephen, what's next for you? What do you want to accomplish at this stage?
Well, I had lunch already, so I guess it's about another couple of hours till dinner. You know, if something comes along, great, but, TV writers my age don't get work. So realistically speaking, I always said if there's something called incels that's involuntarily celibate, there should be something called inret, which is involuntarily retired people. You know, so I would be an inret at this point. I'm available. My agent has my information, but otherwise, I enjoyed what I did, and I watch TV as a fan now. If I do find something I like as a fan.
You're welcome here anytime, and congratulations.
Thank you, Bert.
Yes. That's our friend Stephen Weiner. This was a great conversation about the launch of the Letterman Show and the new Mickey Mouse Club. And our guy, Stephen, two-time Cable Ace Award nominee, Stephen Weiner. You can find out more about our podcast online. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Thank you, Speaker Match, for making it all possible. And thank you for listening. For our guest, Stephen Weiner, ace writer based in New York City. I'm Burke Allen for the Big Time Talker podcast. Now go out and make it a great day. Thanks for listening. Bye, everybody.